that brings us to our speaker tonight, who is Rich B. No home group on here, so you can tell him. Give it a cheer for Rich.
Rich alcoholic. Let's see, the house cleaning stuff. My home group is a 6:15 in the morning meeting. I've got a sponsor. I sponsor guys. My sobriety date is January 4th of 2004. Anything else I'm supposed to add? No? Okay. I also want to thank Rich for asking me to speak. I've been to this meeting a couple times, but I've never spoken here. So, you know, I hear a lot of people speak, and a lot of times I hear people, when they start their talk, they mention that they didn't have like a, you know, TV family upbringing. But I did. The only problem was the TV family that I had didn't look like the Brady Bunch or Leave It to Beaver. It looked like the Sopranos. And I grew up with a family involved in organized crime. So growing up for me, honesty was a bit of an issue. Lying was a life skill. You know, I learned how to lie very quickly and get really good at it. In addition to that, you know, having that kind of an upbringing, fear was another big issue. I can remember being in grade school, and the Pennsylvania State Crime Commission would do a report every year, and they would, you know, list all the organized crime activity in the state. And the Morning Call, the paper, would publish that report every year. So every year, my family's name is in the paper in this report. And every year I would wonder, is this the year that one of my teachers is going to ask me about it, or one of my friends, or one of my friend's parents? Nobody ever did. But, you know, as a kid in, you know, third grade, fourth grade, like, that can mess with you for a little while. So I mention those because those are kind of two ongoing themes throughout my life. As you can imagine, too, I mean, being involved, you know, having a family who that's what we do, you know, my dad didn't go to an office to do business. He went to bars. That's where you do that. You know, it's where you collect money. So as a kid, I spent a lot of time in bars. Sitting, I'd be the only, you know, little kid sitting at the bar with everybody. I remember when Pong came out, I was freaking ecstatic because I finally had something to do, you know. And then Pac-Man, that was even better. You know, my dad would give me a roll of quarters and I'd be gone for a couple hours. But also, I mean, drinking was just, it was just in the air. I mean, it just was what we did. You know, we had a bar in our family room. And that's what we did. We sat around the bar every night. Everybody sat there drinking. And, you know, it was, as a kid, it was glamorous. You know, it was, you know, if you guys, I don't know how many of you guys remember the Rat Pack and, you know, Sinatra and all those guys. I mean, that's what it looked like for me. And I couldn't wait to get started, you know. I remember the first drink I had, I don't know how exactly how old I was little. I remember my grandfather was sitting in his recliner with a glass of scotch, and I crawled up in his lap, and he gave me a little sip, and I remember my reaction was, you know, like, but I also remember always looking for him to be sitting in that recliner with that scotch, and I would climb up in his lap again and get another sip. I probably started drinking, you know, really legitimately when I was about 12. It would be, you know, whenever we could get some beer, but it was wasn't that hard to get. You know, everybody had older brothers and sisters and shit. There was always booze at my house, so it wasn't that difficult. By the time I started high school, it was every weekend. By the time I finished high school, it was every day. When I went to college, it just continued. It just was, I can give you a drunk log. There's a thousand, horrible stories, but, I got out of college and I got a job, and the job sucked. It was horrible. And I can remember, I'd wake up every morning feeling like utter crap. And the first thought would be, I'd say, I'm not drinking today. I'm just going to come home from work and go to sleep. That's all I want to do. And by the time 5 o'clock rolled around, it was, as soon as I got home, it was and just start. And I drank until I passed out. And I did that every night for, maybe like a year and a half towards the end. Just drank till I passed out every night. During the stretch of my drinking, college and after, my pattern was to, I would get drunk, I would bang up my car. I would, hit signs, bushes, mailboxes, curbs. And then, that would kind of be a little wake-up call, like, all right, I got to chill out. And I'd chill out for a couple of months, and then little by little, I'd slowly pick back up and be right back where I was until I banged my car up again. And just kept doing that. When I got out of college, I got the job that I hated, was doing all that. I lost that job. Shocker. Because I would, I'd go into the job completely hungover. I wouldn't even consider doing anything until noon. Then I would go to lunch. I'd come back. I'd fart around for another hour. Then it would be like 2 p.m. Now I have 3 hours to do all the work I was supposed to do in a day. So I would just make it up. I was working for Dun & Bradstreet. I was supposed to call businesses and ask them information about their businesses, and I would just make it up. Just didn't care. I got fired. By this point, I had met a woman who was to become my wife. She was living in Richmond, Virginia. So I lost the job. I had nothing keeping me here, so I decided to go to Richmond. And I got a job tending bar.
Yes.
Of course, right? Perfect. The pattern continued. I was, if any of you have ever worked in the restaurant industry, you get off work at 2 a.m. and you just find other places to go. All the after hours joints, you go there till 5. And that's what I would do. And the pattern continued. I would get smashed. I drove in blackouts. I don't know how many times. I can remember putting my key in the car door to unlock the door. And then I remember waking up at home, and in between there was probably about a 8 to 10 mile drive that I have no recollection of. That's just one example. I did it I don't know how many times. I'm in Richmond. I'm tending bar, still drinking like crazy. And same thing happens. I bang up the car, and I wake up the next morning, and the girlfriend, she just looks at me and she asks me, what happened? And of course, I lied. That's what we do. And she said to me, I love you too much to watch you do this to yourself. And that was the first time anybody ever said anything like that to me. My parents never said anything like that. None of my friends, nobody. That was the first time anybody ever said that. So, you know, and in the back of my head, I had known, I knew I had a problem, but, you know, I just wasn't going to do anything. So when she said that, I decided to try to do something. So this is like 1992. I remembered that a buddy of mine in college was in AA, so I called him up. And the only thing I remember from that conversation with him was, he said, "Rich, you're gonna go to AA and you're gonna hear a lot of stuff." He said, "You take what works for you and you leave the rest." That's exactly what I did. I went to meetings, and at the beginning I kind of went with an open mind, you know, but I was just petrified, you know. So I went, I got a book, I read a little bit, and that was that. I read enough to be scared to death and to not really want to do this. But I didn't drink. And so for the next 10 years, I didn't drink. I would go to one meeting a year to pick up my chip. I'd spend the rest of the year making sure everybody in my life knew that I had this chip, and I'd go to AA. And look how great I am. I'm not doing crap. I don't have a sponsor. I haven't done a single step. I haven't done anything. Now, I'm gonna backtrack a little bit. And I kind of do it that way because I learned this in retrospect. I didn't realize it at the time. But what I've learned in retrospect is that, you know, I started drinking because it was just what we did. But at some point, drinking became medicine for me. You know, I was, basically what it was, you know, the world didn't do what Rich wanted it to do. And that would leave me, and here's the full range of my emotions, pissed off or sad. That's it. And the booze would, you know, ease that pain, that emotional pain that I was in. So where was I? Fast forward. So I'm doing 10 years of not drinking, not working this program, not drinking, not changing. And guess what? The world still isn't doing what Rich wants it to do. And now I've taken away the medicine. So I was effing miserable for 10 years. I do not recommend that as a program of recovery. I was pissed off in the spring-loaded position. Now, you know, I was fairly intelligent. You know, I wasn't going to walk around bashing people in the face with a brick, even though that's what I wanted to do. I knew that was going to land me in a place I didn't want to go. So I would swallow all that crap, and it would come out sideways at somebody unrelated to who had pissed me off. And I was good at, I could verbally cut people off at the knees. I was really good at that. I could make you feel like an idiot. I just was a dick. I was a dick for 10 years. Now during that 10 years, you know, like I said, I'm in emotional pain and I don't have my medicine. So I'm doing other crap to try to ease the pain, other stuff that I shouldn't do. Now I had, you know, that early stint in AA, I had, like I said, I had kind of done a little bit of reading. I knew enough and I had kind of surrendered booze to my higher power. I said, "All right, God, you got booze, but I got the rest of my life. I don't need you over here. I'm good." And then I would do all these other things to try to ease the pain, and I'd wind up hitting another bottom, and it would be like, "Okay, God, you got booze and this, but I got the rest of my life. I don't need you over here. This is good." And little by little, he just kind of kept chipping away at me. Until I finally remember, you know, I did something else stupid, hit another bottom, and this time I just... I'll never forget the feeling. It just, I had nothing left. I was completely empty. And I called out to God and I just said, that's it. I'm done. You got everything. And I always knew that AA was the answer. I just was too scared to do it. Specifically, what I was too scared to do was the fourth step. I had kind of done one, two, and three, you know, at least a little bit. And at that moment, when I was finally done, I had done one, two, and three. I was it. I surrendered. That was my moment of surrender. So I came back to AA, and how much time have I got here? I still got tons of time. All right, so I'll tell you the story. So by this time, I had gotten married to that woman, and we had moved back to Allentown. And we were renting this townhouse, and it was like getting to be late summer. The townhouse had a fireplace, and we knew I wanted to use the fireplace come winter. So there was an old friend of mine who I used to drink with that I had known had become a chimney sweep. Some of you guys may know him, I don't know. But I decided to call Chimney John to come take a look at my fireplace. And he comes over and he's looking at it, and we're reminiscing, you know, talking about old times and yada yada, and we're doing the dance. Like, is he an AA? Like, he's saying, and well, I don't remember, one of us finally just said something like, dude, are you an AA? And we were like, yeah. And we were like, holy crap. And then, like, we talked for, like, another hour. But he told me about the 6:15 meeting, which had just started, like, a month or two before that. And my meeting, my home group meeting in Virginia before we left was at 6 in the morning. And I always felt like early morning meetings, number one, they fit my schedule. It was easy. You know, I didn't have to take any time away from my family because they were all still sleeping. But I also found that, I don't know, early morning meetings, generally there's quality sobriety there. You know, people who are getting up and going to a meeting at 6 o'clock in the morning are serious about their sobriety. They ain't going for happy hour, you know, to see what kind of, you know, fresh meat is around. You know, and that was the case. But like I said, the meeting had just started like 2 months before. So I show up, and at this point, the meeting was Monday mornings only. So I show up Monday, and it's me and like two other guys. And we're like, holy crap. And they start doing their announcements, and they're like, this meeting needs a coffee maker. And like both guys look right at me because I'm new, and I'm like, I guess I'm the coffee maker. So I made coffee for like a year. Then I became the chairperson for like a year. And then the treasurer for like 4 years, you know. But that was cool. That meeting, like I said, it was just Monday mornings at the start. And there would be like three, four of us. And then a couple other guys would start showing up. And little by little, it kept growing. And I remember when we first broke double figures, everybody was sitting there like, we got 10. But little by little it grew. And then we added another day, and now we're there 7 days a week, and we probably average 25 people. On the weekends it's closer to 50 probably. It's been really cool to watch that meeting grow. So anybody wants to go, we're there every day. So he told me about this meeting, and I go. And I get a sponsor. And I told my sponsor my story, and it's funny, I still have never done steps 1, 2, and 3 with a sponsor. You know, because he heard my story and he just said, start writing. Just start writing. And he was right, because that's what had scared me for those 10 years, you know. I I had read enough and read far enough ahead to understand that if I do this step and the subsequent steps, if I do this, my way of dealing with the world goes out the window. And that scared the crap out of me because I'm like, how do I function? I don't know any other way to do this. And it wasn't until, you know, the pain that I was in was so great that the thought was, however awful that, you know, that prospect is of, you know, losing my only way of operating in the world, however awful that could be, can't be any worse than I feel right now. And so I decided to, you know, I just started writing, like he told me. I did my fourth step. That fourth step that I wrote was the first honest thing I ever did completely on my own in my life. I cheated on every test I ever took. I plagiarized every paper I ever wrote. That was the first honest thing I ever did all on my own. I went to my sponsor's basement to do my fifth step on January 4th, 2004. And for those of you who were paying attention, that's my sobriety date. I don't count the 10 years before that because I wasn't doing anything. That's when my life... scratch that. That's when I changed. My life didn't change. I changed. So that's January 4th, 2004. I do my fifth step with my sponsor. And then I go on and do the rest of the steps. My life starts getting really good. You know, promises are coming true. I'm working with other guys. I'm getting to watch them get this program. And everything is really good. Except in my marriage. And this is, so now, this is the next, that's the next 10 years. I do things in 10-year increments for some reason. I don't know why. But I'll let you know in the next 10 years if I figure it out. So for that 10 years, like I said, everything was pretty good everywhere except my marriage. Periodically, I would get the thought, like, I'm not happy. And that would be quickly followed by the thought, yeah, but you were an ass. You owe her. So I wouldn't say anything. Like I said, I did that for about 10 years. And then in, like, late 2013... the thought came again, you know, I'm not happy, followed by, yeah, but you were an ass, you owe her. Except this time, the next thought was, yeah, but you haven't been an ass for a long time now. Like, when's enough enough? So I said something to her. And we went to counseling, we tried to make things work. To her credit, you know, she was doing all the things I was asking her, making all the changes I was asking her to make, and I was doing my part, but something just wasn't resonating here. And at some point I just knew, like, that's it. No more amount of time, no magical couples retreat is going to fix this. And so I told her, and we got divorced. Now, I mentioned that. I know that doesn't sound like it has a whole lot to do with AA. But it does for me, because the lesson that I've taken from that whole process is what's written on the back of our coins, which is, to thine own self be true. You know, I wasn't being true to my heart. My heart kept trying to tell me something, and I wasn't paying attention. And frankly, that's what my heart had been trying to do my whole life, and I just kept drowning it with booze. And then I kept drowning it just with guilt and fear. And so it's been in the last, 4 years or so that how I work this program and what this program means to me and what a it's just kind of changed. We talk about that. The book tells us that alcohol is just a symptom. That's not the problem. And that part of the book always resonates for me because that was my experience. I didn't drink for 10 years. That wasn't my problem. It was a spiritual problem. And I needed a spiritual solution. And for me, my idea of a higher power, my relationship with him and how all that works changes. It grows, it deepens as I keep doing this. That's why I share that divorce story, because that was a huge deepening of my spiritual experience with my higher power. And how I understand and how I interact with the world. It taught me, we also talk about, I came from my drinking, but I stayed from my thinking. And that our thinking is the problem. Well, I know for me, my thinking is absolutely my problem. During that process of, when I was trying to figure out if I was going to stay in my marriage or go, I spent a lot of time in meditation, a lot of time asking questions, and a lot of time trying to listen for answers. And I had an experience, and I hesitate to say that I learned this because I still work at it, and it's not always easy, but it worked in that particular circumstance. I found that, in listening for an answer, the voice of fear is up in my head, and it screams really loud. And the voice of love is in my heart, and it's a little tiny whisper. And so for the last 4 years, my practice and my program has been trying to learn how to not listen to my head and listen to my heart. And then take the action that my heart is telling me to take, because that's a whole nother deal. My heart told me to go, to leave the marriage. It was a whole nother thing to actually go and tell my wife, okay, it's over, we're done, I'm going. Like, that's a whole different thing. To actually do what my heart's telling me to do. And that's when that voice of fear in my head starts screaming really loud. And I believe, I have those decisions between fear and love hundreds of times a day. I'm faced with that decision. And, I'm not perfect. I succumb to fear plenty of times. But the few times that I've managed to listen to my heart and do what it tells me to do, the fruits of that are just incredible peace and ease, and it's hard to even describe. But I it's funny, I'm sitting there going, you know, it's really amazing what that's like, and yet I still succumb to fear over and over and over again. You would think, wow, that's really cool. That'd be easy. That's an easy choice. It's not. It's really not. And that's why I keep coming here. That's why I am grateful for, you know, this program and everybody who came before me. And the lessons that this program teaches. It's a spiritual malady, and it's a spiritual solution that's required. And this program is about getting that connection to a higher power and having it grow and deepen over time. And that's what I try to do, you know. One of the other things that helps me do that a lot is, you know, is coming around, is working with other guys in the program. And just, you know, something my sponsor told me a long time ago has always stuck with me. You know, he talked about 12-step work. You know, he said, it doesn't have to be all AA stuff. You know, you can, you know, go mow your neighbor's grass, shovel his driveway, bring his trash cans up, you know, open the door for somebody. It doesn't have to be AA stuff. Service work is service work. It's just getting out of yourself and helping another human being. And so, you know, I do a lot of that. I don't, you know, I people come to me and I joke with one of my other buddies about this. People come and ask me for help. And I always just, my first thought is, oh, my God, how horrible is your life that I look like the answer to your problems? Like, I don't, that's frightening, but people do. And I try to do my best to help them. And it's not always AA, you know, it's people at work. It's kids I coach. It's, you know, it's everybody. You know, I don't know. To me, that's the program. You know, it's not just AA. You know, if we come in here and all I do is help all you guys, and then I go out there and I could care less about everybody else, you know, that just doesn't seem to make sense to me. So, you know, all of those things are things that I learned in here. I, you know, that is not how I approached the world before. You know, I started off saying, you know, that honesty and fear were two underlying threads of my life, and you know, the honesty piece, you know, that piece about being true to myself and true to my heart, that's how that, you know, comes back into play. And the fear piece, you know, for years, when I was still out drinking, there was just a constant underlying thread of anxiety that, you know, I don't really know how to do life, and I'm faking it pretty good, but at some point, something's going to happen. And it's all, you know, it's all going to come down. The curtain's going to come down, and everybody's going to see that I don't know what the hell I'm doing. And I was petrified. And I can tell you that today, that anxiety is gone. Gone. Not that I'm not afraid of things and fear doesn't come up, but that underlying anxiety that I don't know how to do life, that's gone. I know that whatever life puts in front of me, the answer is somewhere in the first 164 pages of that book. And the beautiful thing is, I don't even have to know what page it's on. I just got to show up here and ask one of you knuckleheads, and you guys will tell me what page to read. You know? And it's just a beautiful thing. And it hasn't failed me yet. And I don't anticipate that it will. I was just sharing this with somebody else yesterday. You know, fear is a huge thing in our program. We talk about it a lot. We do a whole freaking inventory on it. But yet when you get into the book and you look at that part of how it works, you know, the part on resentments, there's a couple pages on that, on what you're supposed to do with that. You get to fear, it's two paragraphs. And it's because, you know, I don't care how many fears you have or what they are, you're going to have three legal pads full of fears. It's the same answer for all of them. Faith. I just have to trust that everything's going to be okay. That's it. No matter what the hell I'm afraid of, everything's going to be okay. You know, all that emotional pain and stuff that I used to drink to mask, you know, I've learned in here through doing this stuff that, you know, booze isn't the solution. And it's a quote that I love, and right now I can't remember who it's from, but the quote is, "The only solution to the pain is the pain." Now, the only way I get through pain is to just feel it and realize that it's not going to kill me. I'm not going to die. I will be okay. Whatever it is, I'll be okay. It's nothing more complicated than that. There's no magic bullet. It's just, you just feel whatever it is you're supposed to feel. And you won't die. You know, that's what I learned. And it's made all the difference for me. I can't, you know, I get asked to speak, and you know, I never know what the hell I'm going to say. Quite frankly, I don't want to know what I'm going to say. But I don't spend a lot of time. The only time I do reflect on my story and my life is when I'm asked to speak, because if I do it other times, I get overwhelmed with. You know, we talk about gratitude a lot, and gratitude is just not a big enough word for what I feel for this program. You know, to give me a way of going through life that I had no idea. You know, I was petrified about how to do life, and today I'm not. Like, that to me, it just is mind-blowing. And it's simple stuff. It's not easy. Simple, but not easy. And I think that's in our book, too. There's nothing complicated about what we have to do and about what I did, you know. I wrote down all my crap. I told somebody else. And then I tried to help other people. And I just had to be completely honest. That's the hard part. And I had to learn that lesson again with my marriage. I had to get completely honest with myself. And a level of humility. You know, understanding that my higher power is the answer, not me. And when I can get me and all my fears out of the way, then everything is okay. I think I'm close. I don't know. That's really about all I've got. Just want to thank Rich again for asking me to come down and speak, and thank all you guys for being here and listening to me ramble.